So today I'm going to give you some background material on functions. Okay?
Of several variables.
So somehow I will start speaking about calculus for functions of several variables or multivariate calculus.
But because this is the other ingredient of an optimization problem. You have a region of the space and you have a function which you want to minimize or maximize. Okay?
But before I come to this, I have to complete you some information about compact sets. I ended the lecture telling you that a subset of Rn is called compact, if it is closed and bounded. Okay? Bounded means that it is included in a ball of large enough radius, and closed means that the complement is open, or other way you can think that all limits of sequence of points in the set belong to the set itself. You cannot escape from the set. Okay? And earlier I showed you these results which I call the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem. Which was saying, suppose you have a sequence in Rn, and suppose that, I told you this way, suppose that the norm of all the points of the sequence are below some threshold value n. Okay? In other words, this can be written as the sequence is contained in the ball of center 0 and radius, okay, let's make it this way, and radius n. Okay? And I told you, if this is true, then the sequence has at least 1 plus the point. Okay. Well, we can enhance, we can give a stronger version of this result, which provides a characterization of compact sets. Okay, so this is a stronger version of the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem that says that a subset D of Rn is compact if and only if any sequence contains any sequence of points contained in the set D has at least 1 plus the point, and all the cluster points of the sequence belong to the set. We will mainly exploit this version, the weaker version, okay, of the theorem, because we will build sequences, we will show that the sequence is bounded, and then we are guaranteed the existence of a cluster point. But
The existence of cluster points and the fact that they belong to the set is a characterization of compact sets. Okay? As I already told you, we will build algorithms which generate sequence of points. So, and we will show generally that the cluster points of the sequence have the properties that we wish for. So, the goal would be to have sequences which are contained in a compact set. Okay, so that we are guaranteed the existence of a cluster point and that the cluster point belongs to our region. Actually, in a moment I will show you another very useful consequence of compactness, a property which is very relevant. But for this I need to start speaking about calculus for function of several variables. Okay? In a few minutes I will show you a theorem that is due to Weierstrass, which is called the Weierstrass theorem, which states that if the function has certain properties and if the region where you consider the function is compact, then the function has minima and maxima. Okay? And which is the property which we need? The property is continuity. Okay? So, I will say that the function f is called continuous at a given point x bar in Rn if, first let me write it in informally in words and then we will make it formal. If the value of f at x bar is the limit of f at x as x goes to x bar. What, why did I tell you this is informal? Because we have considered limits for sequences, okay? Here I'm not considering a sequence, I'm just saying x, a generic point, goes to x bar, okay? And then I speak of the limit of this quantity as the point goes to its limit, okay? So I need to make this formal. And this is what have you already seen in calculus for function of one variable. The formal definition is almost the same. You just replace the absolute value with the norm. Okay? So it's the usual epsilon and delta definition. So this means this will be often written as the limit as x goes to x bar of f at x. This writing means the following, that however, however you choose an epsilon, there exists a positive epsilon, there exists a delta, such that the difference of f at x and f at x bar in absolute value is less or equal than epsilon whenever the norm, the distance between x and x bar is less or equal than delta. Okay? Just take the absolute n equal 1 and the absolute value here is the usual definition of continuity for functions of one variable. Okay? It means that to guarantee that the value of the function at the point is arbitrarily close
to the value of the function
at x bar,
it is enough to take the point close enough, the moving point close enough to the limit point. Okay? No matter how small I choose this threshold, I will always be able to find a ball of center in x bar and radius small enough in such a way that in all the points of the ball, the value of the function is closer than the threshold to the value of the function at x bar. I think that the definition will come more familiar to you if I restate it through a characterization. Okay? So, this is a proposition you can prove. F is continuous at a given x bar in Rn if and only if okay. Any sequence xk that converges to x bar as k goes to plus infinity, so this is a usual sequence, the standard sequence with the classical index given by the natural numbers, is such that satisfies that the limit as k goes to plus infinity of the number f at xk is equal f at x bar. Okay? These are numbers, so this is the classical limit of a sequence of numbers. Okay? So it means, if I'm approaching a point, it means exactly this. This is x bar. I'm approaching x bar through an arbitrary sequence. Then also the sequence of values of the function approaches the values of the function at this point. Okay? Very roughly speaking, in one variable you can say I can draw the graph of the function around the point without having to take the choke off the blackboard. Okay? Take this as x bar. Let's say this function is continuous x bar. The value of the function here is done this way and here is done this way. Okay? This is not continuous. Okay? Because if I take this point, they convert a sequence of points here that goes to x bar. The sequence of values goes to this value here, while the value of the function at the point is this one. Okay? It's exactly the same thing, except that you here you don't have the line of the basic calculus, but here you have Rn. Okay? This line represents the full space Rn. Is it clear? And now I can formally state the result which I told you, which is probably one of the most well-known theorems in basic mathematical analysis, which is the theorem by Weierstrass.
which states the following.
Let's consider a compact set so a closed and bounded set and a continuous function f from Rn to R. Be continuous, let's say, on D.
What does it mean? I told you continuity at a point.
Okay, here it is. Well, the definition is up there. Continuous at a given point.
Continuous on a set means continuous at every point of the set. Okay?
This means it is continuous at any S bar which belongs to D.
Okay? Generally, when I will tell you this is a continuous function, I mean it is continuous at every point of the space. Okay? Well,
if this is true, then F
has at least,
let's say, has at least one maximum and one minimum point over D. This means that there is two points x bar and x up, both belonging to D, such that f at x bar is the minimum of the value f at x as x belongs to D, which means f at x bar is less or equal than f at x for every x in D. This was the very starting point of the lecture last Tuesday, and the same for a maximum point.
Okay, so I told you that we will spend all my lecture trying to study the mathematical properties and the algorithms related to this problem. Weierstrass theorem says, well, if your function is continuous and the set you are considering is a compact set, then you are guaranteed that your problem has at least one solution. Okay? On my lecture notes, you find the proof. Okay. The basis of the proof is the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem. Okay. So I don't give you the proof. I just give you a short sketch. First of all. Well, I don't know if, let's say we prove the first part for minimum point, the other is symmetric. I don't know if such a point exists, okay? But I know, since this is a set of numbers, okay, I know that this set of numbers as an intimo, okay? Estremo inferiore, okay? This intimo might be even minus infinity, but it exists, okay? And by definition, since this is an intimo, there is a sequence of values here, which will be f at xk for some appropriate point xk, that goes to the extreme, to the intimum. Okay? This is the definition of the intimum of a set. It's smaller than all the values, okay? And it is the biggest of them all, which means I can find a sequence of points here, which of values done this way, which converts here. But these values are done this way, they must come from some points, points which are in D. And D is a compact set. Okay? Since D is a compact set, I cancelled the wrong way, version of the theorem. Since it is a compact set, this sequence has at least one cluster point. Okay? A subsequence converges. And then I apply this proposition here to show that, okay, let's see, xkj converges to some cluster point. I apply this proposition here to show that f at x bar is equal to the intimum. Okay? So the sketch is the following. You use the definition of the intimum, which provides you a sequence in the compact set, which by the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem has at least one cluster point, and the cluster point is the point you are looking for. Okay? If you want to dig all the details, they are just six lines, okay, on the lecture notes. But the crucial points are here. I can find this part because here I can take a converging subsequence. I can take a cluster point. And then I have this property that comes from continuity. Okay? Indeed, there are better results in which compactness and continuity are relaxed as much as it's possible, but it doesn't matter to us. We are happy with continuous and compact. Okay? Let me just give you an example. Let's consider f equal 1. Okay? So the function is just a function of one variable, and let's consider e to the minus x, and let's consider the set D made by all non-negative points. Okay? So if I want to draw the graph of the function, the graph of the function is this. This is f, and the set D is this one. D is this half line. Well, you know that this function over D is always greater or equal than zero. Okay? And indeed, zero is the intimum. But there is no point at which the function takes value zero. Okay? E to the minus x is never equal to zero. It's always positive. Okay? But as x goes to plus infinity, it becomes closer and closer to zero. Okay? So this function does not have a minimum point over there. Okay? What is going wrong? Well, the function is continuous. You can check it, it's easy. Well, the set is not bounded. Okay. This is not bounded. And therefore, it is not compact. Okay? So we are missing compactness. This is relevant because in the very first part of the course, I will mainly deal with the case in which D is the full space. Okay? And if D is the full space, we don't have boundedness. Okay? So that Weierstrass theorem for the first part will not be useful. And you will see some funny trade-off. Solving problems where D is not bounded is somehow easier or less difficult to solving problems where D is compact. Okay? But when you have the full space, there may be no solution. When D is compact, you are guaranteed that a solution exists, but it is more difficult to find it. Is it clear? Okay, now we need some more difficult concept. So today and tomorrow will be somehow a brief summary of calculus. Students used to have two courses of mathematical analysis a long time ago, one in the first year and one in the second year, and in the second year they were studying functions of several variables. So I will give you just what it is needed from calculus, okay? With no proofs, almost no proofs. I will try to give you idea. When you take a function of one variable, so when you take a function from R to R, you know how to do calculus. It has been taught to you during the first year of your undergraduate course. You know what a derivative is, what a second order, what a second derivative is, and so on. Okay? And also you know some property related to minimum and maximum. Okay? The trouble now is, okay, I don't have a function from R to R, but I have a function from Rn to R. Okay? Well, how can I make derivatives here? Okay. So this is the question I try to answer today. Okay. How did you do when it was a function of one variable? Well, when it was a function of one variable, you were saying, well, I take this incremental ratio. Okay. For h, and then I try to compute the limit as h goes to 0. For a fixed s, and for a fixed point, let's say x bar. Okay? And this is the definition. Then you have easy rules to compute the derivative of a polynomial, of trigonometric functions, and so on. Okay? But the basis is here. What's the difference now? Well, the difference now is the following. If this is R, this is a number. Okay? And then I can make the ratio. Okay? I compute the variation of the function divided by the variation of the point. Okay? Well, but if now I come to Rn, These are no longer numbers. This is a vector. Okay? So I cannot put a vector here. Okay? This is a number, this would be a vector. This becomes meaningless. There's no sense in this writing when n is greater than 1. Okay? R is a line. Okay. It's simply a line. If I take, let's say, n equal to the plane, I have an infinite number of lines. Okay. In R2, this is a line, this is another line, and so on. Okay. Essentially, in R, I have just, up to the sign, I have just one direction. Okay. I have just this direction. Okay. Or, it's opposite. Okay. But in R2 or in Rn, I have this direction, this direction, this other direction, this other one, and they are not the opposite of each other. Okay? So this is the first difference. And, well, the first idea to make derivative is, okay, let's fix a direction. Okay? So we are in Rn. Let's fix a vector d in Rn, which is not okay. Let's say it is enough that the vector is the non-zero vector, but then dividing by the appropriate length, we can suppose its length is unitary. Okay? Its length is 1. If I consider this set of points, x bar plus t times d as t varies into R, I am describing a line. A line that passes through x bar and d provides this direction. Okay? Or its opposite. Okay? I'm in Rn. This is the one-dimensional restriction. Okay? It's a line. It's somehow a copy of R. Okay? The basic idea to compute derivative is to consider your function just on this line. Okay? So let's try to reproduce this definition, but restricting your function to the line. Considering your function just on this line. So, I will consider the function as x bar plus t times d, and the function as x bar. Okay? X bar and d are given, they are fixed, so I can consider this as a function of t. This is the function computed for t equals 0. Okay. I can consider the function g of t, which provides the value of f at x bar plus time t times t. Okay. This is a function from R to R. Okay. And this is from R to R, so I can compute its derivative. Okay. If it is clear. So I can considering is the incremental ratio of g is considering this ratio here, okay? F at x bar plus t times t minus f at x bar divided by g, okay?
Okay. And here, when I make the derivative, I take the limit for t that goes to 0. Okay, this depends not only on f, but also on the derivative, that on the direction, sorry, that I have chosen. Okay, so this limit, if it exists, is called the directional derivative of f at the given point x bar in the direction d. What is the difference with the one-dimensional case? All the difference is here. I have to specify a direction. Okay? In R, you don't have to specify a direction because there exists a unique direction. Okay? You can move just along one line. Well, here, you can move along this line, and it is different than moving along this other line. Okay? So, we will say that if this limit here exists, then it is called the directional derivative of the function in that given direction. Okay? This is the standard notation. This is the standard notation for that. For that, in the case n equal 1, you were used to this simple notation, simpler notation. And the notation could be simpler because you did not have to specify the chosen direction. Okay? Well, there are particular directions. Let's say we are in R2. Let's say the axes are centered in X bar. Or you could also consider 0 and then we repeat them in X bar. You could consider the canonical basis. You could consider the vector 1, 0 and the vector 0, 1. More generally, in Rn, you could consider the vectors ei, which means the vector which has all components equal to 0 except component I, which is equal to 1. Okay? In Rn, a1, a2, an provide the so-called canonical basis. Okay? So you could make the directional derivative for those particular directions. Okay? So, the directional derivative with respect to these particular directions are called partial derivatives. Okay? So, this is called, the definition is exactly the same, so this is called the partial derivative. I partial derivative. Okay. And the standard notation for this is not putting here EI, but the standard notation is putting there FI. Okay. The ith component of the vector x. Why is this? Well, if you write this, It is exactly like when I make this limit, everything is fixed except the highest component I, because I'm adding zeros, okay, except for the component I. So this is actually different. X bar 1, X bar 2, and so on. X bar I minus 1, X bar I plus T, X bar I plus 1, and so on, minus F of X divided by T. Okay? Because here I'm adding all zeros except two component I. Okay? So this is the vector, I have written explicitly the vector X bar plus T E I. Okay? It's the same vector of the vector X except here. Okay? So here you are fixing every component except component I when you are considering this limit. Okay? It is as if you were considering the function of a function only of component I. Okay? All other components are left fixed. If you consider one component only and the other, let's say you consider them as parameters, that becomes once again a function of one variable. Okay? So this is the reason why this is the usual, the standard notation. Okay? Indeed, when you deal with people who don't want to spend some time to speak to you about multivariate calculus, you say, okay, multivariate calculus is the same as you have all components, you fix them all except one, and you consider the function as a function of the unique variable you make change. Okay? And then apply everything you know from the calculus for functions of one variable. Okay? That is the easy way that you are addressed to this topic. And I will try to convince you that it is not a good way to state things. Okay? Because there's a bit more than this. Okay? But then when you will have to compute derivatives, you compute them in this way. You fix all the variables except one and you make the derivative applying the usual rules. So this is the reason why people tell you. But from a mathematical precise point of view, it is not exactly the same thing, and I'll show you why after some break. Let me just give you probably the most important concept we are going to face from calculus, which is the concept of the gradient. So, if a function f has all partial derivatives, all of them, the vector whose components are the partial derivative is called the gradient of f at the point. So, if the derivative with respect to the first direction of the canonical basis exists, the same for the second component, and so on for all the components. So if all partial derivatives exist, the vector made by this partial derivative is called the gradient of f at x bar. Simple exercise for the break. Consider this function of two variables. So n equals 2, so f is function of a variable x which has two components, and it is the sign of p x1 times x2. Okay? Compute the two parts of the integer.
Now we take a break and then I will give you the answer.